foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group, since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace.
Marcy Winograd, welcome to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and lots of other community radio stations, such as KBOO in Portland. You can also hear us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Do check out our website, codepink.org, where you'll find the latest on our campaigns and all of our radio episodes and podcasts. On this episode of Code Pink Radio, former diplomat Anne Wright will talk about her planned trip on the emergency flotilla to Gaza to break Israel's siege. Then a conversation with Code Pink's Palestine campaign coordinator, Noor, on Israel's greenwashing. On the second half of Code Pink Radio, author and strategy organizer Eric Mann talks about building a mass movement to challenge settler colonialism. Code Pink's Anne Wright, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, and hundreds of other human rights activists with the Freedom Flotilla Coalition are due to set sail on multiple vessels in mid-April to carry 5,500 tons of aid for Gaza. Their mission, aside from delivering the much-needed humanitarian aid, is to challenge Israel's illegal blockade of Gaza amid dire conditions, including widespread hunger, mass starvation, lack of medical aid, intentionally caused by Israel's policies. Time is running out for many in Gaza as Israel threatens an all-out attack on Rafah. And experts warned hunger and disease could soon surpass casualties from bombings. I'm Marcy Winograd. I am here on Code Pink Radio with Anne Wright, a Code Pink sister who is due to set sail on a Freedom Flotilla to Gaza sometime in April. Welcome, Anne Wright.
Thank you, Marcy. Great to be with you in Code Pink Radio, the greatest radio in the world.
That's right. Now, Anne, I know that you're excited about trying to break the siege of Gaza, that you're due to set sail, and this is imminent. A lot of us are in knots just thinking about you. You're so precious to us, you and Medea, and we want you to be protected. Tell us about the trip, how it came about, and who's organizing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what we're calling the emergency flotilla because of the emergency of the genocide of the people of Gaza by the Israeli horrible 6-month attack that's killed 33,000 people, left 75,000 wounded, tens of thousands under the rubble. And we, as the Freedom Flotilla Coalition that's been working together for 15 years, and has been sending boats to try to break the illegal Israeli naval blockade of Gaza, even though we know that we are stopped. But it's important for the world to remember that it is there is a naval blockade of Gaza going on. And so it's for the publicity that we do this, to get more publicity for the plight of Palestinians. So the emergency flotilla, which will be in mid-April, is our response to the genocide. And we've put this together since November, of trying to find ships, cargo ships and passenger ships that we can get to get applicants that we trust that will be nonviolent in face of probable violence from Israeli commandos that may board the ship. I mean, we hope that we will be given passage into Gaza, but the probabilities are not that high. I mean, the history is there. We've sent flotillas in 2010, 2011. 13, 15, 16, 18, and 23. And they have all been stopped in international waters in what the Israelis claim is their, well, their self-declared exclusion zone, that no one can go into that zone, which can go out to 100 nautical miles off Gaza. No one can go into it unless the Israelis say so. And just the same as they're saying, nobody can go in on the land unless we give permission to it. And nobody can go into air because the Israelis tore up the one airport that was in Gaza back in 2005.
So, Ann, who's going with you?
Well, from the we're going to have delegations from, we anticipate 30 different countries are going to have representatives in this flotilla. From the U.S., we anticipate we will have about 40 U.S. citizens that will be on it, and from all over the United States, to include my state of Hawaii, with two of us coming from Hawaii. But we'll have Medea Benjamin, Code Pink founder, co-founder, is going to be going. Tide Berry, great Code Pink supporter, is going to be going. Colleen Rowley, whistleblower for the FBI, is going to be going. John Heuer, who is one of the great civilian protection people. Elliot Adams, who is a nonviolence expert from all over the world. Lisa Fithian is going to be going to train in nonviolent techniques. Matt Ho, former Marine captain and State Department person who, like myself, resigned from the State Department over its policies of Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of them will stay in Istanbul and just do the training and help with all the administrative things, but we anticipate we'll have about 40 people that will be on the ships.
And should you be confronted by the Israeli military? You mentioned you're being trained in nonviolent tactics. Is there going to be an orchestrated response of any kind from those on the flotilla?
Well, it will not be any sort of a violent response. We will not respond with violence to the violence that is aimed at us, because that's the kind of the key to nonviolence. But there are certain techniques that one can use to express displeasure with what's happening that is less than using force on a violent perpetrator. So we will be trained in those techniques. The bottom line is the people, first, we hope that the international community will be putting such pressure on the state of Israel that it will allow this cargo ship, which will be, it's a huge ship, 5,500 tons of goods we will have, which is 20 times larger than what the Central World Kitchen had on its barges. We will have a lot of humanitarian cargo and medicines on it. So we will be asking the world's governments to finally put pressure that equates in the Israelis stopping the killing, a ceasefire, and letting civilian ships in, and not waiting for the United States 60 days from now to build a pier at the request, essentially, I think, of the Israeli government. I mean, for the U.S. to, oh, we'll give you bombs. Oh, and yes, oh, we'll take us 2 months, 3 months to build a pier that maybe the Israelis won't bomb. I mean, we see what happened to the World Central Kitchen guys that had the permission of Israel to be on the roads and all, and they blew them up and have killed over, I think it's 150 aid workers already. So nobody trusts the Israelis, and that's what makes this a very, very dangerous mission. And we're so proud of the people, over 350 from the English-speaking and Western European and Southeast Asian countries who have said, we're going to go on this. Even though it's dangerous, we're going to go, because it's important to the people of Gaza that they know that governments don't seem to be doing anything, but at least citizens are trying to show, again, you know, the criminal actions of the state of Israel on the people of Gaza.
Well, we applaud your efforts because, as you said, the governments are doing Very little. I mean, we see some governments. We see South Africa taking Israel to the World Court, charging Israel with genocide. We see Nicaragua filing a lawsuit with the World Court against Germany for sending its arms into Gaza. So there are, and I just read that Colombia is going to support South Africa at the World Court. So that's good news. And I believe Ireland is as well. But like you said, this isn't enough.
So what our mission is people themselves taking to the high seas to show physical action of trying to get ships in there to Gaza to relieve the starvation, to show the Israelis that citizens of the world are taking action, even though our governments are action in words, but we're trying to take physical action to say the genocide must stop.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. You are very courageous, and we hope to stay up to date with you.
Indeed.
Who are on the flotilla. So thank you so much, Anne Wright, for joining us on Code Pink Radio. I'm Marcy Winograd for Code Pink Radio. It's a great honor to be here with Noor. Noor is the Palestine campaigner at Code Pink. She has written a terrific article paper for DePaul University in Chicago, where she is based. The title of this paper is Israeli Greenwashing, The Myth of Environmentalism in a Settler Colonial State. Not a lot of people are talking about this, but it's critically important, particularly as we face this climate crisis, that we make these connections between the genocide in Gaza, the oppression of Palestinians, and this worsening climate crisis. Let's first thank you for joining us. Welcome, Noor.
Thanks, Marcy.
Sure. Okay, so in tackling the myth of environmentalism, you know, Israel being this leader in environmentalism, you say it's really necessary to deconstruct or define three concepts. One, greenwashing. Two, settler colonialism. Three, dialectic nature of political ecology. That's a lot. So let's take one at a time. What's greenwashing?
Yeah, so the reason why I think it's important to understand these concepts before understanding, you know, really diving into like how settler colonialism worsens the climate crisis is because it's important that we're all on the same page about like the facts and the truth. So greenwashing is a form of propaganda. As we all know, Israel loves its propaganda. But basically, it refers to literal and figurative use of like greenery or green initiatives by any entity. Could be like a government, a corporation, an organization, to basically distract from or conceal evidence of like displacement, destruction, basically to show something like shiny in place of like real environmental destruction that's being done by these entities. Yeah.
So greenwashing, a lot of greenery, but underneath it, it's filth, right? Thank you for defining that. So let's move on to the next one that you talk about, settler colonialism. You say it's really important to understand the context, and that being settler colonialism. How would you define that?
Yeah. So settler colonialism. So first, it's important to distinguish it from like regular colonialism, basically when, you know, one country colonizes another, right, puts its own government in place. Settler colonialism has that settler aspect of it where there are settlers that are coming to a land, and inherent to that means like the removal of the indigenous people on that land. So that's a really important aspect of it to note. And settler colonialism, the way I see Western settler colonialism, is having like three main distinguishing features. One is white supremacy, which it gives like this air of the colonizer is better suited for this land because they're going to do something, you know, much more productive with it. And that kind of feeds into the next aspect of it, which is capitalism. Settler colonialism is inherently capitalist, and that's important to note in the context of environmentalism, because the approach that a colonizer will take to the land that it's colonizing is one of exploitation, right? Max profit. So that's, you know, kind of antithetical to environmentalism, right? We don't want to exploit the earth. And then also, settler colonialism is like a continuous project. The indigenous people and the land will continuously have to be colonized as long as those settlers are staying on that land, you know, until the indigenous people are extinct through genocide, or exile.
Which is
And
what we are witnessing today
exactly. And
in Gaza. So, okay, so we've talked about greenwashing, greenery that distracts or covers up efforts to oppress others or eviscerate them. We've talked about settler colonialism. Now let's move on to the third concept you frame in this article, dialectic nature of political ecology. That's a lot. So what does that mean?
Yeah, I think it sounds a lot more complicated than it actually is, but it's kind of to just, when we're thinking about this, have this mindset that the social order, you know, our like human way of life and the environmental order are inextricably linked with each other. There's like nothing that we can really do in our social order that's not going to affect the earth and vice versa, right? Like people adapt to the climate that they're in. So these like ma a major change in the social order is gonna have a major change in the environmental order and vice versa. And that is just important to note because when you think about indigenous people who over time have really developed a relationship with the earth, that's kind of the closest thing we're gonna get to equilibrium with the earth and like this balance of the social and environmental order. Not that I think it could ever actually be an equilibrium, just because that's the nature of life, like things push each other in and out of equilibrium. But indigenous people's understanding of the land that they're on is the closest thing that we'll get to that. So you can imagine when settlers come in, there's like a huge disruption there.
Absolutely. And yet, you know, growing up, I grew up in a community that was 99%, excuse me, Zionist. And I was fed on this myth that Israel made the desert bloom. You talk about that in your paper, Noor, your paper, Israeli Greenwashing the Myth of Environmentalism in a Settler Colonial State. So let's smash this myth. Let's deconstruct it that Israel made the desert bloom. It's like, oh, there was nobody there before, our land without a people, for people without a land. And along comes the Zionists, and they literally made the desert bloom. Tell us why that's not true.
Right. So first of all, it's this idea that like the desert even like has to bloom in the first place. I mean, it does, but you know, we don't need to take these like concepts that like maybe apply to like Europe or like other environments and like try to replicate that everywhere else in the world, right? Like that's just not how the earth works. But you know, in the springtime, the native plants in Palestine are just like this carpet of color. So there's really no reason to bring in like other species, environmental, you know, like different plants to make that happen because it already does happen on its own, right? And like you said, it kind of pushes this idea that there's nobody there, right, to do that, to take care of the earth, to make the desert bloom. When really Palestinians have been cultivating the earth in Palestine for so long that it's flourishing. I mean, there's so many great places in Palestine for agriculture to really be successful. Just the different types of native plants in Palestine that sustain Palestinians economically and, you know, just like their own necessities, like whether it's like sustaining their food supply, et cetera. Figs, grapes, oranges, olives, you know, these are all plants that really thrive in Palestine. But the reason why this is actually so ironic is because the main organization that this initiative is pushed through is the Jewish National Fund, which has, you know, this initiative of like plant a tree in Israel, quote unquote, Israel, where people can pay to have pine trees planted in Palestine, which are not native to Palestinian land. They're actually horrible for the soil. They erode the soil. The pine trees there don't even thrive. Like, if you look up an image of them, if you go see them yourself, they're not green. And those are like evergreens, right? Like, they're supposed to be green. So that doesn't even happen. It erodes the soil so that plants that are native to Palestine aren't even able to thrive there anymore. And they take up a lot of water and they dry out the earth. So, it's caused a lot of issues like forest fires. It takes water away from Palestinians in their homes. And then also, these trees were used. So, when we talked about greenwashing, we talked about literal and figurative ways to distract from, environmental issues, right? So, literally, pine trees have been used in a village called Ikret, which is near the border of Lebanon and Palestine, to cover up acres of farmland where figs, grapes, and olives once grew and flourished. So, in order to create, to help like sustain this narrative that nobody lived there, pine trees were built all over this farmland so that, traces of life before Israeli occupation, before the settler colonialism of Palestine, could just disappear, right? They could just continue this lie that nobody lived there, when in reality, people do live there. And actually, Ikrit is now the largest military base in Palestine.
Whoa, a lot of what you say resonates very deeply with me because, as I mentioned, I grew up believing these myths. It wasn't until I was older, when I was in college, and I was in a bookstore and I saw a book, the title of which was Israel Without Zionism, that I started thinking about this. And so people say, "What is going on? Why are so many people indoctrinated?" It's like a brainwashing. Literally, grow up from a very young age believing Israel, a land without a people, people without a land, made the desert bloom, and all of those myths. And
I get
then
it.
suddenly, oh my gosh, I've been lied to, maybe not intentionally, right? Others believed these myths,
Yeah, I
but
get it.
now.
It does sound true, like it does, you want to hope that the people who tell you these things are coming from a good place, especially when they're saying like we're helping the environment, your first thought is going to be, okay, this is a good thing. Like I want to believe it. I want to be maybe even be part of it. So I do understand falling into that thinking, because that's the purpose of propaganda, right? It works. That's why it's used.
Exactly. And it's been a very powerful propaganda campaign, as we see now, right? With the world allowing this genocide to occur, sending arms, the United States being the largest arms supplier to Israel, 69%, I've read, 30% from Germany. And that's why we see Nicaragua taking Germany to the International Court of Justice. The US has filed an Article 9 reservation saying, whoa, the courts, this is the highest court of the United Nations, does not apply to the United States, even though we signed this treaty. So therefore, other countries are being targeted by at the ICJ. So Nicaragua has filed this case against Germany, and we hope that all, people who are listening and who are supportive of Code Pink and supportive of Palestine's liberation will draw attention to this case, as well as the case that South Africa has brought against Israel for genocide. So, getting back to what we were talking about, your terrific paper, Israeli Greenwashing: The Myth of Environmentalism in a Settler Colonial State. Noor, you also tackle this myth that Israel is a leader in environmentalism, that we can look to Israel to develop solar energy and water conservation. Let's smash that myth too.
Yeah, so a lot of these initiatives you'll find are actually like, okay, the settlers in Israel, like in, maintaining this Zionist settler colonial project, they messed up. They really messed up the earth because they don't know how to deal with it, right? Like the nature of a colonizer is one that is not familiar with the land that they are, settling on. So in, doing all these things like planting pine trees, and just like generally not knowing how to work with the earth, not knowing how to nurture the earth so that it nurtures you back, they kind of created a bunch of issues. One being this like issue with the water, right? Planting these plants that don't thrive in a desert environment where maybe the amount of water that they need doesn't actually match the capacity that of water that they have, right? So, more on that is that not only are they exacerbating these problems, it's that when they're actually trying to solve these problems, the way in which they're doing it is to actually take resources away from Palestinians. So the water, for example, Palestinians don't, and I'm just gonna talk about the West Bank, because right now, if we talk about Gaza, nobody has access to clean or safe, safe access to clean and reliable sources of water right now. Even before this intensification in the genocide, that was the case. But if we are just focusing on the West Bank, right? Palestinians in the West Bank don't have like the free-flowing access to water that, we have in like the United States, for example. Actually, Palestinians have like water tanks on top of their homes where they have to store water for the days and times where they don't have water. And the World Health Organization actually like recommends 100 liters of water per day per person. And at the time when I wrote this, Palestinians were getting, I think it was 70 liters per person per day, or 80. So regardless, it was below the amount that they were actually supposed to be getting. And what are, the Israelis living on colonized land getting? The daily recommended amount and more, because they have like the free flow access to water that we're like familiar with in the US. Not only that, but when illegal settlements are expanded on and like more and more are created, which is illegal under Israeli law. For those who like might be unfamiliar with how this happens, a bunch of Zionists will literally go to land, like say in the West Bank, and like start settling there and start just deciding that they live there, which, like I said, is illegal under international law, but also is illegal under Israel's own laws. So when they do that, despite it being illegal, Israel will still like provide them with like water and electricity, while Palestinians who might live like just like a street over, aren't getting the amount of water that they need in a day. Another way, we talked about electricity and like this solar energy initiatives that like Israel, goes about having. So this like initiative of solar energy in Israel is actually super ironic again, because while uplifting Israelis and like uplifting Israel itself in like the international order as like pioneers of environmentalism and saying like, look, we're even looking at different ways to source energy. In that vein, know that they're all also always suppressing Palestinians at the same time. So this solar energy initiative that, they're being put on a pedestal for, they're actually denying Palestinians the right to have access to that solar energy as well. And actually, when a independent group came in, so not through like the Israeli initiative of solar energy, when they came in to occupy Palestinian territory and said, okay, we're going to help Palestinians actually, also have access to the solar energy, Israel destroyed all of that infrastructure. So they clearly don't actually like abide by these like morals and principles of environmentalism. If that was the case, then they would want everybody to have access to it, right? They would want there to actually be a real impact on the earth for using solar energy. But that's not the actual intentions behind them partaking in initiatives like these. The real reason is, one, to just support settlers, and settlers are always their, number one priority. And two, to be able to look at the rest of the world and be like, hey, look, like we're good, we're, forget about the ethnic cleansing, forget about home demolitions, and like, look, like, you know, we're using solar panels, like we are a green country, and you know, we're progressive, and therefore, you know, we should be supportive. And you know, like you said, like these narratives trickle out, even if it's not like in these international forums where Israel is being put on a pedestal. It's kind of like, you know, the regular everyday narrative, the cultural narrative of Israel is one I've even heard of people like saying that they have like amazing green initiatives. So one, they're not actually great. A lot of times they're doing harm. They're always suppressing Palestinians in the same vein as them uplifting settlers and making sure they have access to this like technology. And also the intention behind it is one in the context that we were talking about earlier, like the settler colonial context. You know, nothing that comes out of this settler colonial framework that inherently disrupts the lifestyle of the indigenous people, murders them, exiles them from their land. Nothing created in that context can actually have a true positive environmental impact because the foundation of it is literally antithetical to environmentalism.
Absolutely. From what you're saying, what I'm thinking is if we really care about the environment, if we are supporters of environmentalism, we have to be supporters of the liberation of Palestine and all people who are colonized. We have to tackle these myths, and it's not easy because, as you said, they're so ingrained. I read that, I think it was Anna Baltzer in her book, fabulous book, Witness to Palestine. She talked about how, yeah, people are asked to buy these Israel bonds. Or to buy, invest in trees in Israel without realizing these trees are designed to cover up Palestinian villages. This is all part of ethnic cleansing. They don't realize that settlers in the West Bank have swimming pools, while, you know, a block away, Palestinians, indigenous Palestinians, are rationing water or have to ration their water. There's so much injustice here. And I really appreciate your article, which we hope to see in a magazine, yeah, soon. Israeli Greenwashing: The Myth of Environmentalism in a Settler Colonial State by Noor, Code Pink's Palestine campaigner. Any last thoughts you want to leave our audience with, Noor?
I think to just always, you know, have this like approach of a people who are indigenous to a land have, you know, created this relationship with that land that, you know, was cultivated over generations, and they have such a deep understanding of the land that surpasses just like knowledge, and it is actually this like loving relationship. Like Palestinians, we love our land. We love our olive trees. These things have kept us alive for generations. And, you know, seeing that destroyed, and when our people are destroyed, you know, those things are not separate from each other. Like when our people are murdered, like the genocide of Palestinians is ecocide as well, because we sustain each other. We are in relationship with each other, and we can't be separate from each other, which I think all of this kind of demonstrates. So I would just love for people to always kind of have that in mind, and to just always, you know, be kind to the earth and question when people are, you know, trying to project the fact that, you know, they're doing so good for the earth. Like, think about maybe why they need to, you know, put up such a front. What are they really doing behind closed doors? It's always good to investigate things.
Good point. Yes. So I would just urge everyone who's listening to join with Noor at codepink.org. You can join the Palestine campaign and support the liberation of Palestine and environmentalism. Protect the earth. Let's dismantle settler colonialism. So thank you, Noor, for being with us. Great to see you.
Honestly, thank you for all your work.
في الصبح بكير منحط بودرة ومناكير مندور عن معنى قوانين بدها تكسير منقول الله كبير منشكي ما حدا بسمعنا حاسة حالي بتحرك لحالي
I'm Marcy Winograd. Welcome back to Code Pink Radio. It's my great honor to be here with Eric Mann, who is the director of the Labor Community Strategy Center in Los Angeles and founder of the Bus Riders Union. Eric has been a civil rights, anti-Vietnam War, labor, environmental organizer with the Congress of Racial Equality, Students for a Democratic Society, United Auto Workers Union, Soledad Brothers, and Attica Brothers Defense Committees. Eric has written 6 books and is working on 7. His books include Comrade George, Taking on General Motors, LA's Lethal Air, Dispatches from Durban, the 2004 elections, and Katrina's Legacy. Eric Mann is also the co-host of the weekly radio show Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK Pacifica's radio station in Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, and has published more than 200 articles that have appeared in the New York Times, LA Times, Boston Globe, Black Agenda Report, The Nation, and more. Welcome, Eric Mann, to Code Pink Radio.
Thank you, my friend Marcy. Nice to see you.
Yes. All right. So, Eric, your latest article, which I read in Counterpunch, terrific article, published at the end of February, is titled, "The Palestinian Resistance is Winning. The Movement Must Expose and Defeat Netanyahu's Final Solution to the Palestinian Question." That's a lot. Let's unpack that. You say the Palestinian resistance is winning. And yet, Eric, we are reading daily that Israel, with weapons from the United States and Germany mostly, also the UK and other countries, have killed or maimed over 100,000 Palestinians, turned Gaza into a graveyard for children. How is that winning?
Well, let's start with the heartbreak. When I say winning, and I believe that, I'll talk about it. You know, when I worked against the war in Vietnam, I did believe the Vietnamese were winning. I also knew our government was going to be killing 4 million people in Vietnam, dropping napalm, cluster bombs. It broke my heart. And I didn't get up every morning thinking the Vietnamese are winning, as much as I have an obligation to stop this damn war. And that's what I begin with, is the moral outrage of this atrocity, this continuing atrocity. And because so many other people have talked about this, I do want to talk about what I mean by winning. The first thing I think people have to understand as an organizer, which I am, is that you have to have a very long view of history. Somebody just said Netanyahu is playing the long game. He's not worried that much about all this outrage. He knows what he wants to do. Well, yeah, but the Palestinians are playing the long game too. And they have a long understanding of what's happened to them and what they plan to do. So given that the world is so terrible, where's the hope, as I always tell people? Well, the first thing, you made a lot of it. I'll start with the fact of the wonderful pro-Palestinian, anti-Zionist demonstration at Radio City Music Hall, where they had this love fest between Biden, war criminal, Clinton, war criminal, and Obama, war criminal. And they're all there to raise money for Biden. And the press says, in the middle of it, somebody jumped up said, "You're a murderer, Joe Biden." I also think the militancy of people right now, the consistency of people fighting. You know the international situation much better than I do. But we know that there's cracks starting to be inside the imperialist alliances. And we know about the South African charges for genocide, which the Israelis don't care. They keep carrying out genocide. But over time, this is my, what's the end game? Because I have to have a strategy. I have to really envision the end. The end is the People's Republic of China gives arms to, there's a world war if needed, because this is not just happening in Palestine. Biden is trying to have a world war against Russia, China, Iran, Iraq, Venezuela, Cuba. Well, at some point, forces are going to move. And at some point, somebody's going to say, "Israel, sorry, you're now a liability in this whole world falling." That's what I believe. Just like in Vietnam, there was a point where the ruling class couldn't do anything. That doesn't mean that we don't do the great things you're doing every day. But you have to contribute to the split inside the U.S. ruling class, which is what I think we're doing.
Yeah, so that's a very important point that you're making, Eric. I find myself in conversations with friends, with the political activists who are very pro-Palestinian, with them saying, got to vote for Biden, got to come out and support Biden, got to campaign for Biden because Trump is fascist. Trump will institute so much civil unrest. Trump will never see another election again, and on and on. And my response is, and I would love to hear your thoughts. My response is, look, if Biden's genocide is not a red line, then there is no red line.
I think formulations are very important. So your formulation, which you said on the show and said, if genocide is not your line in the sand, you have none. I think that's a great moral challenge. Now, there's people that want to talk about Trump, Trump, Trump. And I say, look, on November 1st, maybe we'll talk about that. But until then, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the existing president is carrying out war crimes. And you're talking about Trump. It's like mind-blowing because anyway, the more point I think is this, I want to write in some movements. Look, we on the left can argue about electoral strategy. You can think the defeat of Trump is very important, but at this moment in history, that's not where my mind is. The people who are doing the anti-war work right now, including me, are on the front lines of history, but I want people to hear something. During the war in Vietnam, some of us built a base in the school system. We had teachers against the war. We had students against the war. We had black communities against the war. That takes time. That takes time to have building relationships with people, building structures of resistance. It doesn't work on a 6-month timeline. All the other stuff has to go on, but it's when, in fact, your union stands up at a union meeting and debates Palestine, even if it vote is 2-1 for it, the system is worried about that. That's why they went after the president of Harvard so hard, because they don't want institutional organizing, which is what I do. Which moves on a very longer term. It doesn't mean you don't fight every day with what you've got, but right now we're working at Augustus Hawkins High School, and black students are walking out because they're taking people's cell phones. They're, basically creating a police state. Those students need to see Palestine as part of their struggle. That's the work that we do, is work with people who are in direct struggle against the system and talk to them about internationalism. That's why we're going to the LA Times Book Fair on the 20th and 21st. And the books there, Marcy, are going to be like How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, The 100-Year War Against Palestine, Eric Mann's Playbook for Progressives, 16 Qualities. A successful organizer. We have a film showing on April 11th of The Old Oak with Ken Loach. What I'm getting to, well, why am I doing this if there's all this murder in Palestine? Because I have to build a movement around films and books and struggle so that we have something new to bring to the table, new forces. And I think all of us have to be doing two things at the same time, fighting against the system in the minute. But are you building a base? But if you say the arc of anti-imperialism is based on grassroots organizing, you have some hope.
I so appreciate what you're saying, Eric. And as I listen to you, I think, I haven't done this. I haven't done that. Right? I live on the Central Coast in California and started with a few others the Central Coast Anti-War Coalition. We've got an email list of about 400 to 500 people. And we're out there, film showings and trying to shut down Raytheon and this and that. But still, so much work to be done, like you said, with the long range. In mind, of building alliances with unions and churches, a temple, temples if you can. But institutions, institutional organizing is so critical. I appreciate that message. Eric, I want to talk about our background as Jews.
Sure.
We both grew up in Jewish homes, Jewish neighborhoods, where we heard over and over again, Israel, a land without a people, for a people without a land. A very powerful statement. I don't know about you. My awakening was in college. When were you awakened to this idea that, you know, this is really indoctrination, a settler colonial project based on ethnic cleansing of Palestine that has been sold gift wrapped with a ribbon to Jews around the world? So tell us about your own awakening.
Yeah, well, Marcy, you know, by the way, I was thinking something this morning that, you know, our friendship is so important, you know, that when I talk about fundraising, I said, people give money to people. They don't give money to groups. They don't give money to causes. If they like you and believe in you, they'll go, well, you're a little too radical for me, but sure, you're a really sincere person. And if they don't like you, doesn't matter. You can have the same exact ideas. And then, I don't know, no thank you. So I think at the end, it's personal connections. So I don't know if this is even apocryphal now, but I think it's true. So I used to go to Saturday morning services, you know, in Valley Stream, Long Island, a center of white racism and everything else. And I loved it, you know, the challah, and I would get for the challah and the pickled herring, but I liked the Torah and the marching around and the kissing the Torah, and I thought it was beautiful. And everybody was so nice. This guy gets up and says, we all need to plant a tree in Israel. And my family always wanted to plant a tree in Israel. They said, you know, because it's nothing. It's a desert. It was empty. It's almost like we inherited this vacant lot that we have to do. But then he said, in any way, those people had it for 2,000 years and they didn't do anything with it. I went, wait. I thought you said it was empty. By the time I got into the civil rights movement, Marcy, we were all for Palestine. Every one of us. All the Jews who went down to Mississippi, all the Jews in New York. We were with the Black movement. We were part of an anti-colonial movement. And we love Palestine. I don't know one Jew who went down to Mississippi who was for Israel. So, that's irrelevant. Let me just say one thing. It's relevant to the fact that the work I'm doing in South Central is going to be critical to building this movement in support of the people of Palestine. Because if people understand they're colonized, and then if Jewish people would do a little bit more work, by the way, in South Central, which they don't, we could strengthen that alliance. But back to the point, there's always a point where the light bulb goes off as a Jew. And I go back to the hatred in the voice of the people. It felt like a racist mob in the synagogue. And I understood it viscerally. And I'm proud of that.
Eric, when you said it sounded like a racist mob, that's an analogy that some would find problematic. I can remember, you know, not too long ago, the University of California at Santa Barbara near me shut down this multicultural center on the campus. Why? Because students at the center, which was established, I think, in the 1980s, posted around 100 signs on windows and doors, some of which said, silence is complicity, no more genocide. Some said, Zionism is terrorism, Zionists not welcome. And so someone close to me said, well, you know, that's really anti-Semitic, Zionists not welcome. And I said, well, what if you substituted the word racist, not welcome? Would you have such a problem with it? And there was a long pause. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to expose Zionism as racism.
Yeah, and I think when you said there are some who may not like that you said it's a racist mob, I'm actually judicious in my rage. I mean, you have to be very smart how you say things. I stand by that. I'm saying I was terrorized by the hatred in my synagogue. And I felt it. And you hear it. I mean, you don't think, going back to my article, Netanyahu, the final solution to the Palestinian people, listen to how he talks. he talks like Hitler. The rage, the anger, the righteousness, getting Israeli people to really say, like in the Battle of Algiers, Colonel Mathieu says, "Do you want us to control Algeria? If you do, don't criticize my methods." And that's what Netanyahu is saying. If you want to get rid of the Palestinians, don't tell me about war crimes. And the tone of how he's trying to whip up the Israeli soldiers, the Israeli, I mean, how do people go with a gun and shoot a kid? How do you see a child with no food and see that child as an enemy? Only through racism, only through chauvinism, only through xenophobia can you so dehumanize someone in order to kill them.
Critical question, and I've been
Please.
thinking a lot about this one.
Please.
At what point will the United States, the Biden administration, the Trump administration, whoever is in power, Congress, ditch Israel? Say, you know what? This is too much. Oh, we don't want you as an ally. Well, we don't need you as an ally. We have the Fifth Fleet based in Bahrain. We have the largest military base in the Middle East, in Qatar, for a 10-year contract. What do we need Israel for? Do you foresee this?
Well, again, I want to thank you and Code Pink for the level of your understanding of the international situation. You bring me a lot of facts. I want to thank Jody and the whole team, Medea, you. I mean, you guys are on the front line. My show is called Voices from the Front Lines. You're on the front lines, and you're also on the front lines intellectually because I read your stuff. I'm one of those people that when I get the email, I actually read it. So I want to start there. I don't know. I don't want to be overly. I think what I sometimes say in organizing is, sometimes you just put your head down and smash it into the wall. And most of the time you get a concussion. But once in a while, there's a crack in that wall you didn't see. Organize in your workplaces. I want to say one more thing is important. Yes, organize in the synagogue. Stand up in the synagogue and say, "This is wrong. This is total. I'm with the people of Palestine." You may not last another 4 minutes, but don't think it doesn't shake people up. It does. One person who you trust and know, who looks like you, unfortunately, think, you think is one of you, says, "No, this is wrong." The reason they, why do they kick you out? Because that idea has an appeal to whatever the Jewish people think they're doing, which is not what they're doing. The belief that they're moral people, the belief that we're the chosen people, which is in itself a racist concept. The reason that I've succeeded is I can go into a union meeting where I work in that factory and I say I support the people of El Salvador. And they say, "Shut up and sit down." But they also say, "That's Eric. He's on the assembly line next to me. He's a good guy. And you know what? I think he's got a good point." So I'm urging people there. You march in the street, it's not as hard as marching into your family, marching into the way you work, marching into your union, march into your church, and stand up and say, "This is morally wrong. Who will join me?" I say to you again, march on Saturday, but Monday morning, where do you live? Where do you work? Have the guts to stand up in a majority hostile group because you can move the group to you. You can't.
Well, those are very inspiring words and motivating words, and I couldn't agree with you more. It is more difficult to have these conversations with people who you have been close to or you have an affinity with in some other arena. So thank you for your wisdom, Eric Mann. Thank you for your guidance, your insights. We so appreciate you, and thank you for being with us on Code Pink Radio.
All power to the people, Marcy. I'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to Code Pink Radio, featuring former State Department diplomat Anne Wright. Setting sail soon on the emergency flotilla to Gaza. Also, Noor, our Code Pink Palestine campaign coordinator, on why Israel is not green but pretends to be. And longtime author and activist Eric Mann on building a powerful anti-war movement through community organizing. I'm Marcy Winograd. Join us at codepink.org. Peace.
Carlisle Group since years before. Been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say Code War,
we say Code Pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say Code War,
we say Code Pink.
Code Pink.